Morning, Chief Justice Centel, and may it please the court. I've asked to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. Under the prior orders governing the 800 megahertz band, Nextel and public safety users were to exchange channels by June 26th of this year. Under the order at issue, Nextel may be required to vacate some of its channels on that date, even though Nextel will be ready to move, but some public safety users will not. The FCC did not find and could not reasonably have found that Nextel is at fault for the failure of those public safety users to be ready to move. And a number of public safety users have sought extensions of the June 26 deadline, and they have assured the Commission that they are not suffering interference problems. Nextel's network will be severely harmed if it is forced to vacate channels for reasons that are detailed in the confidential declaration that's included in the supplemental appendix before this court. Dropped and non-completed calls will increase to levels that are simply unacceptable, and it's worth noting that while there are 20 million subscribers using using Nextel's IDEN network, 3 million of those work in the public safety related areas, and their calls will not go through or will be dropped at the same rate as anyone else's, and that there are 28,000 911 calls each day made on Nextel's network, and those calls will be dropped or will not go through at the same rate as other calls.
Well, Mr. Wright, before we get to the problems that Nextel is going to have and the merits of this question, let me ask you about jurisdiction. Because, of course, the Commission argues that you never raise these issues properly before them.
Well, Your Honor, the Commission seemed to misunderstand in its brief that we only submitted one two-page paper, and of course we met. Well, a moment of background. The Commission issued the order at issue without any notice to Nextel or other affected parties. We learned about it on August 23rd of last year from the trade press. We set up meetings immediately with the Chairman's office, each of the four commissioners, the Bureau in charge of the order, and the Office of General Counsel. Each of those meetings was, the fact of each of those meetings was recorded under the Commission's rules by an ex parte letter. And the ex parte letters, I submit, provide a very nice summary of the argument I'm presenting today and a very nice summary of the briefs we filed in this case. In particular, we emphasize, quote, that acceptance of the 800 megahertz obligations was premised on receiving synchronized replacement spectrum. That's at JA 817, and in each of the other ex parte letters. That is my argument today. We think that Nextel's acceptance of the 800 megahertz obligations was premised on receiving synchronized replacement spectrum, and the Commission's departure from the synchronized replacement spectrum approach is unlawful for a number of reasons. The letter, the single two-page letter, said swap 5 times, used some form of synchronize 5 times, and used both acceptance and accepted. We pointed out the point I've already made, that Nextel's network serves many public safety users, and they will be injured if Nextel is forced to vacate the channels. So the question is whether, under this court's precedent, whether the Commission had a fair opportunity to respond to the issues presented.
Commission and the public. I'm sorry. I thought the purpose of the regulation requiring that you memorialize the ex parte meeting was so third parties would also be on notice in case they wanted to.
But that's absolutely true, too. I guess I was going to say that even focusing on the letter, I don't think anyone could fail to understand our argument that our acceptance of the obligations was premised on a swap, not on Nextel vacating and then getting channels at some time in the future. And of course, Your Honor, we had the 6 meetings, which were 30 to 60 minutes each, and which detailed the argument, you know, in a way that the two-page letter was simply a summary of.
You initiate your argument here in your brief in terms of contract law, which sounds like Tucker Act review rather than APA review. You seem to back away from that in your reply brief, if I read you correctly. But is this a contract action or an APA action?
It is not a contract action, Your Honor, and while
so your brief's a little deceptive on that point.
Your Honor,
one, the FCC abused discretion because it cannot agree to be bound by a contract and then use its power as regulator to rewrite the contract. Then you cite Windstar, which was a contract action, as your principal authority for that proposition. But you're now saying this is not a contract action.
No, it's not a contract action, Your Honor. Our position is that the commission has departed unreasonably from the supplemental order and the initial order back in 2004, and as we argue, that's a straightforward APA violation. It has departed from that. But let me just note, without even acknowledging that it is departing from it, the commission, I hope I can get to the point of showing just what a departure it is, but the commission doesn't acknowledge the departure. And of course, one of the most basic rules of administrative law is that an agency needs to acknowledge a departure and explain why it's departing. The contract aspect of this case is unusual. It's very close to the secondary retroactivity sorts of analysis that this court is more familiar with. And again, Nextel's, Nextel accepted the obligations put upon it, including an obligation to pay billions of dollars, potentially uncapped, in order to accomplish a goal that the commission could not accomplish itself. As we come here, it is undisputed that the FCC could not have issued the orders it issued in 2004. It could not have ordered Nextel to pay to move public safety users, a requirement that was simply, there was simply no good way to solve the interference problem in the 800 megahertz band without moving the public safety users. They don't have the money to move. Nextel agreed to take on that responsibility. I mean, Nextel and the public safety users got together and developed this plan and proposed it to the commission. Now, we think it does add a layer to secondary retroactivity analysis. At least shows that it was very important that there was an agreement made that the commission's departing from that is prior to its 2004 orders. The commission, in paragraph 342 of the initial order, took the unusual step of requiring Nextel's CEO to send it a signed letter saying it was accepting the obligations. And the commission premised its order on that signed acceptance. There was a ceremony where Chairman Powell and the CEO shook hands. The commission in paragraph 87 of that order required Nextel's general counsel to send it a letter saying, renouncing the opportunity to bring certain sorts of Windstar actions. The commission obviously has known from day one that this is a contract. And again, we are not here seeking a remedy for breach of contract. And under this court's Megapulse decision, that's the main jurisdictional point, that it's the remedy you seek that's important. We're not seeking damages. We're not seeking specific performance. Perhaps we should have been more clear in the caption, Chief Judge Sentell, but we're claiming that it is a violation of the APA duty to engage in reasoned decision-making to depart from the obligations, to depart from the deal in 2004, and that we would normally think that when an agency takes the unusual step of doing something it can't do under its powers, under the statute, that it something it can only do if it gains the affirmative agreement of a party, that it has a duty to be a bit more clear, certainly, that it probably is generally very difficult for it to then change course. Perhaps it can in minor ways, perhaps there are hypotheticals where it could, but and the U.S. Airwaves case, Judge Ginsburg was the author, provides some support here. That was a secondary retroactivity case. The court said it adds an element to our review that the agency would have to prove not only that it satisfied normal APA standards, but that it had good reason to make its rule retroactive. We think there should be a similar duty to explain why an agency would be departing from a contract. But if I may, all of our legal arguments depend on the idea that the FCC is departing from its 2004 orders. And if I could just take a minute to pin that down, this was an issue of negotiation in 2004, frankly. In paragraph 198 of the initial order, the commission set up a four-stage process for rebanding. And the first stage, it said that Nextel was going to have to vacate channels 1 to 120 in 18 months. And Nextel told the commission it would not agree to that requirement. It needed to hold on to those channels until the public safety users were ready to swap. And so paragraph 52 of the supplemental order provides, quote, that Nextel may retain its channel 1 to 120 facilities while the band is being reconfigured, unquote, and adds that, quote, only as a last step in the process would former channels 1 to 120 become available for use by the NIPSPAC licensees, the public safety licensees. So this, and it was only after the supplemental order that Nextel's CEO signed the letter agreeing to the deal, and Nextel's general counsel signed the letter renouncing certain sorts of Windstar actions. So this was an important part of the deal to Nextel, as its insistence on that shows.
I'm bending you ahead. I realize I am, and maybe you'll get back to where you were, but is there now, on the present review, a difference in your entitlement as to the 1 through 120 and on the one hand and the interleaved bands on the other hand?
Well actually, Your Honor, that's where I was going next. Because
let's
the step three in the initial order in paragraph 198 said, quote, step two is the public safety users relocate, and then step three is, quote, Nextel relocates its systems from the interleaved portion of the band into the vacated NIPSPAC channels. Now, Nextel did not quarrel about that part of the initial order because it's really very clear after the NIPSPAC, after the public safety licensees move, then Nextel vacates its channels in the interleaved portion of the band. That's what the agreement was. And again, it's very important to Nextel that be in the deal. And Nextel will be greatly harmed if it is required to vacate its channels when there are not channels in the upper end of the band to move into, Your Honor. Let me respond to a couple of the arguments the FCC has advanced, one of which is that it's just enforcing the deadline. Your Honor, it's not just enforcing the deadline. The 36-month deadline applied to everyone. Nextel is ready to comply with the 36-month deadline. Nextel can move its systems on June 26th of this year. Public safety users are not. There are a couple of extension requests in the joint appendix. One from Fairfax County is most detailed, explaining why they can't move. Nextel is not sitting here unreasonably saying force the public safety users to move. We understand why the FCC. We can't force the public safety users to move. We can pay for it, but we can't force them to. Nextel is being very reasonable here, and it is. if you sit back for a minute, it is very odd that one party is able to fulfill its part of the bargain, another party is not, and the FCC is effectively punishing the party that's ready to comply. This is a situation where the reasonable thing to do is to do part of what the commission did. The commission said, okay, stay where you are, Nextel, but on 60 days notice, you'll have to be ready to move. Nextel has agreed with that additional obligation, and that is a sensible resolution of most of the real world problems here. With respect to interference, the FCC also says, well,
is that interference element different with respect to the interleaved channels as opposed to the 1 through 120?
There's no evidence that in the FCC's brief it suggests that interference is worsening. There's no evidence that it's worsening. Our impression is that it's not, which actually makes sense for two reasons. One, it's not because the interim interference rules that are in effect now are stricter than the rules that were in effect in 2002. They're not as strict as the rules that will ultimately be in effect, but there should be less interference now than there was in 2002 because rules are stricter. Second, Nextel has already moved some of its channels out of the interleave band. In the two-step process, Nextel moved some private companies from channels 1 to 120 into the interleave band. Nextel has removed its channels, which are cellular high capacity channels, out of those bands. So there are now fewer channels in the interleave band, fewer Nextel channels in the interleave band now than there were. To justify its order on this ground, the commission would have had to marshal some serious evidence of interference. It hasn't done anything here, even close to that. And again, we also pointed out to them that whatever effect any interference might have, and Fairfax County and the others have said they're not experiencing it, it would surely be outweighed by the 3 million public safety folks who are using Nextel's network, whose calls will be dropped or won't go through at all, and by the 28,000 911 calls that will also be dropped and not go through. The FCC did not respond to that argument at all. And of course, failing to respond to an argument at all is the hallmark of an unreasoned decision.
I'm sorry, where is that argument put before them?
It is in the ex parte letters that are reprinted in the joint appendix.
Could you be more specific?
Yeah,
sure.
Please.
If you look at JA 814, or I'm sorry, 816, the second paragraph.
I don't have that. I have 817. Could you read that to me then?
Sure. If you have 814, the letters are very similar. And while I didn't mark that one up, I think it's the same place. First responders rely significantly on Sprint Nextel's IDEN network, particularly in emergencies. On September 11th and again in the emergency response to Hurricane Katrina, Sprint Nextel's IDEN service was the only mobile communications available to many first responders. And I know that it picks it up again that...
what does it say about disruption of their service?
Well, the last sentence there, it would seriously harm public safety by disrupting responders' communications. This action would also squander scarce spectrum resources. And by the way, the commission did respond to this letter. The first sentence of paragraph 26 of the commission's order cites the letter, but then gives a thoroughly unresponsive response to anything that's in the letter. But the commission knew about the letter. This was not a large docket focused on this issue. Again, the issue only came, the commission didn't ask for notice and comment, and the issue only came up on August 23rd, and there was a big hurry because the commission wanted to hold its meeting on September 11th for symbolic reasons. So it was a very truncated proceeding, and the...
Where in the order is this?
Paragraph 26, I hope, is at the beginning of the joint appendix. It's a JA-9. And it's the paragraph that starts, "We disagree with Sprint's contention that requirement to vacate Spectrum by June 2008, quote, would seriously harm public safety, unquote, and, quote, squander scarce Spectrum resources, unquote." And the site is to Sprint's September 6th ex parte letter.
To the contrary, Sprint's timely Spectrum claim achieves important public interest objectives in this proceeding, will eliminate the risk of harmful influence for relocating mixed back licensees that would result from Sprint continuing to operate in demand after an impact relocation has begun. Second, will simplify and expedite transition process. So they did respond. They may have not adequately, but they did respond, right?
But they did respond. There is no response to sort of, well, what about the 3 million public safety users who use Sprint Nextel's network? There's no response to that.
Is that in what you read a moment ago?
I didn't see
from 8/14.
But sorry, I guess we didn't
say. They failed to respond to the 3 million that you didn't put in there.
Okay. They didn't respond that first responders rely significantly on Sprint Nextel's IDEN network, and there it will. Excuse me.
They did respond in terms of what the benefit would be in terms of NetSpec licensees.
Well, okay, first, they didn't respond to the harm to Nextel, and I'd say they sort of conclusively fashioned one sentence saying that it'll reduce interference. Where's the evidence cited to in the record for that?
Do they have to give a silver response to a Sal's here comment, Council?
Your Honor, I think they need to do more than they did here, especially, again, when this was all a creation. The need for expedition here was all a creation of the FCC's desire to get an order out very quickly for reasons that had nothing to do, really, with getting this process moving. This was a response to the September 2007 order, to the extent it was a response to anything, was a response to the report Nextel had filed in January of that year. There was no need for a rush here, and again, none of Nextel's filing certainly didn't have anything to do with suggesting that it ought to be required to vacate its channels.
Is the commission correct in saying that Nextel vacating these channels will actually simplify and expedite the transition process?
No, it's not, Your Honor. I mean, Nextel has agreed to move with 60 days notice. No one disputes that they can give 60 days notice. In fact, an unusual feature here is that the Fraternal Order of Police, who have more than 300,000 members, many of whom use Nextel service, have filed an amicus brief on our side. APCO has filed an amicus brief on the commission side, but as we noted in our reply brief, it has told the commission that it has no objection to Nextel staying on the channels until public safety users are ready to relocate. And again, there's no citation or explanation. That's simply an announcement that doesn't make sense, and certainly can't justify, again, the extraordinary harm to Nextel's network here. Thank you, Your Honors.
Yeah. Hear from the government.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Joel Marcus for the FCC in the United States. I'd like to start out with some of the jurisdictional issues that were brought up briefly. If I may, Chief Judge Sentell, you had asked about the Tucker Act issue that's presented here, and Mr. Wright's response was that the court, under the court's precedence, what counts is the relief you're asking for, and I don't think that's quite right. I think if you read the Megapulse case, and I'm going to read from 672 F. 2nd at 967, the court held there that an action against the United States, which is at its essence a contract claim, lies within the Tucker Act. And in other words, Megapulse and cases that followed Megapulse, I'll provide citations to those if the court would like, essentially set up a dichotomy. There are two possible boxes that an action can fall into. It can either be an APA claim or it can be a Tucker Act claim. But it can't be both. You can't have a contract claim that you recast as an APA claim. And in fact, in the international engineering case, which is relied on in Megapulse, the court specifically takes that up and it says, basically, there's relatively few claims against the federal government, against a federal agency that can't somehow be described as an APA claim instead of a contract claim when they're really based on a contract. And Mr. Wright may be correct that under Megapulse, the relief you're asking for is potentially relevant to determining whether something is or is not a contract claim, but he has cast his whole case, as you pointed out, Chief Judge Sentell, as a contract case. He has said from the opening argument of his brief, this is a contract. The FCC has, he's very careful to have avoided the word breach the contract, but he says change the contract, alter the contract, reneged on the contract, whatever we've apparently done. And but it's always contract, contract, contract. And he stood up here just a few minutes ago and said that the CEO of Nextel came in and shook hands on the deal. What do you do when you're shaking hands on the deal? Making a contract.
However, and I'm not asking you for a concession, but it is the case that Megapulse did not involve an order. It was a contract.
That's correct. And I don't think that this is...
We could look upon his argument employing so many contract terms as simply a poor framing of an argument that is otherwise saying the commission acted arbitrary and capricious.
You know, I think that the court would have discretion to characterize it that way, but I think that it's not quite as simple as Mr. Wright was suggesting, and I think that the Megapulse and...
I really had to wonder why they pleaded so much in terms of contract and APA action.
Well, I don't know, but, it's their choice, and I think that if that's their choice, it's fair to hold them to the consequences of their choice, because there are cases that do involve administrative orders. I think that Sharp v. Weinberger, the citation to that is 798 F. 2nd 1521, was more of a implied contract case that involved an order. That had to do with a Department of Defense order that changed the status of reservists, and one of the changed status reservists was saying that the government breached a contract when it issued that order. I think the Trans-Ohio case, which is, the citation is 967 F. 2nd 598, also addresses these issues. And so I think you're right, Chief Judge Sentell, that this is, I'm not arguing that this is absolutely a straightforward application of these principles, but the principles can easily be considered to apply here. And I think if the court goes back and reads these cases, it will see that having, that Mr. Wright's having pitched this as a contract case, that it's not unfair to hold him to the consequences of that method of argument, and that you can't have a foot in both camps. Although I will agree that the court has discretion here to decide otherwise. There is another threshold jurisdictional aspect of this case, however, as Judge Brown raised with Mr. Wright, there is, I think, a major 405 issue here, and there are two aspects to the 405 issue. The first is whether the letter itself adequately preserved the claims. And I think if you look at the letter, and again, this is going back to the same pages of the joint appendix on 816 and 817, but Judge Ginsburg, are you missing page 816?
Actually, I have only quotations in the briefs. Your brief quotes 817.
817, okay. Well, 817. On 817, this is, you'll see the part where Nextel actually makes the legal argument that it, purports to be making now. And it says, in addition to pointing out the policy flaws, and the policy flaws are all those things about how you'll disrupt our IDEN network and all that stuff. He says, we describe the procedural and legal infirmities. And then they say, Nextel's acceptance of the obligations was premised on receiving synchronized replacement spectrum, period. That's it. What they're doing there, I think, is they're reciting their state of mind. Now, their state of mind is very important to the case that they're now bringing before this court. It's the kernel of their argument, perhaps. But I think that it's not any more than that. And I think it's what the court in Alianza, which is cited in our brief, referred to as the grist of the argument. And I think that as we argued in our brief, as in Alianza, and as in a number of the other cases like Watch and Northwestern, the point is that they raised the argument, or really they alluded to an argument, and then they didn't make anything of it. They didn't actually make an argument. And you will not find anything in these letters about contract, breach, secondary retroactivity, Trinity Broadcasting, Windstar. They've submitted an entire brief on this stuff, and they say that the one sentence, our acceptance was premised on receiving synchronized replacement spectrum, that sentence basically it necessarily included all of the arguments they're making now. And I just don't think that you can read it that way, and I just don't think that you can read this court's precedents and say that based on that sentence, the commission had a fair opportunity to address all of these issues that Mr. Wright is now bringing before you.
I take it, Mr. Marcus, that you're not making an argument at all that the submission of that the ex parte meetings, if adequately memorialized, constitute presentation to the agency.
I was going to turn to that exactly next, which is the other aspect of the 405 question here, and that is basically what you just asked. Are the oral presentations themselves adequate? And I think that in this case in particular, the answer is absolutely not.
Is that in your brief?
Well, we did not argue in the brief that the oral presentations were adequate because at that time I had been informed that the oral presentations hadn't made any of these arguments.
This is an anterior question of law, whether oral arguments presented one by one to the commissioners, if adequately presented and memorialized in a post hoc letter, constitute submission of the argument to the agency.
I think that because the argument here was so inadequately memorialized, our brief never really did reach the issue of whether the oral presentations themselves, in the absence of an adequate memorialization, would be sufficient. That was really an issue that's raised in the reply brief, Judge Ginsburg. And so, we submitted a 28J letter to the court last week that described the commission's ex parte rule and the requirement of that rule. And it's very interesting because the ex parte rule says directly, there can't merely be a listing, quote, more than a one or two sentence description of the views and arguments presented is generally required. More than a one or two sentence description.
Well, the one or two sentences on which you focused are the ones that present the legal argument as opposed to policy.
Okay,
argument, right?
That's about 90% of their case.
But the rule isn't limited to the legal arguments because the third parties need to be apprised of the policy arguments.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you.
So
I think that it applies to both.
They haven't given a one or two sentence description of the meeting. They've given a two-pager.
I think that proves that they knew how to do it when they really wanted to. And I think that what's important here is
it proves that the policy arguments were predominant. That's all.
Okay, well, so maybe they've preserved their policy argument, which I will be happy to address on the merits, but in terms of breaches of contract, secondary retroactivity, Trinity Broadcasting, all the stuff that's 95% of their brief, that's certainly inadequately
documented.
What
about their APA claim that this is an unexplained departure from a prior understanding?
Well, again, they allude to the prior understanding in that one sentence.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're talking about this as a departure, what does that mean? I mean, their argument now is that two specific paragraphs established, in the underlying order, established the prior understanding. Paragraph 198 and paragraph 52, which I will address on their merits. But again, reading that letter, you don't really know what they're referring to in here. You're not given a fair opportunity to confront the specific arguments that they want to make, to confront the way.
Did the commission really doubt that their position was that they had didn't have to move until the swap was completed?
Well, I think
I think that
it puts you on notice that Nextel or Sprint's state of mind, their subjective state of mind, was that they didn't want to move. I think that
I understand their position to be a bit more strongly stated than that.
No. I'm talking about in terms now, of course, but in terms of the letter itself, I think that fairly read, that letter says we didn't expect to move. We don't want to move.
What did you understand the prior understanding to mean?
Well, it doesn't talk about the commission there in the sentence that we're talking about, Judge Sentell. It says Sprint and Nextel's acceptance was premised on receiving synchronized replacement spectrum. I read that as saying this is what we thought it was about. I don't read that as saying this is what you established in your order in paragraph 198 and paragraph 52. I don't read it as addressing that at all. And that's why I think this letter is, not consistent with the ex parte rule, Commission Rule 1.1206. And I think that if you're going to get into this business of relying on counsel's post hoc representations of what he said at a meeting where you weren't there and I wasn't there, you get into some very dangerous territory, because the fact is, I don't really know what was said at that meeting. And if you look at the HBO case, which is cited in the reply brief, the citation to that is 567 F. Second, and the relevant discussion begins at around page 55 of that very long opinion. The court goes on at length about the danger of oral ex parte presentations and about the risks involved in the court trying to review a record that exists only as spoken voices from 6 months ago.
Where these regulations came
from. That's exactly right.
Yeah, so
that's exactly right.
That
and so,
seems to be why they actually have to memorialize what they've done. And
that's
I don't
exactly
see
right.
Anything in your brief that says what they represent here is not true.
Well, again, I couldn't argue that because I wasn't at those meetings and they weren't arguing at the time that they were relying. Well, somebody was, but it wasn't me and it wasn't you.
There was a meeting with OGC, wasn't there?
There was a meeting with personnel from the general counsel's office. I've talked to people who, after the fact, who were in the meeting. To tell you the truth, I've gotten conflicting reports about what was and wasn't said at those meetings. I think the only way to, if you want to rely on what was said at the meeting, then let's appoint a special master. Let's take testimony. Let's have an evidentiary finding about what was and wasn't said.
What do you understand the purpose to be in the ex parte letters?
Well, the principle.
You didn't need a special master to take evidence.
Well, no, but that's the point here, is that the purpose of the ex parte letter is to avoid that kind of thing. It's to put everybody on fair notice. And I think that just, Judge Sentell, that just is in my favor here, because the documentation here is so clearly inadequate.
Did any other interested party seek to meet with the commissioners after this ex parte letter was filed?
I'm not sure. I don't know. And if I could certainly inform the court if it wants to be later on, but I don't know the answer to that question. These meetings do happen, rather frequently. I would like to address the merits if the court has no further questions on the jurisdictional aspects of this case. I do think that the court should dismiss this case on either one of the jurisdictional grounds. But turning to the merits, I think that the commission's basic position here is that time is of the essence in eliminating interference from the 800 megahertz band and in freeing up additional spectrum for use by public safety officials. Nobody doubts that there is a significant and serious shortage of public safety spectrum available. And it's the shortage in public safety spectrum that's actually one of the principal risks to public safety. They've been you know, coming to the commission and documenting the shortage for a decade now. And it is the getting more spectrum into the hands of the public safety agencies that will do the most to promote public safety, you know, the robustness of the communications here. And and the commission was operating, it's a policy judgment here, was driven by the need to get the extra spectrum and to reduce interference in the band, particularly the interleaved band, which is where the most significant interference is taking place now, within 36 months.
Yeah, that may bring me back to one of my favorite questions here. That is there a difference in the record evidence for interference in the interleaved bands and as opposed to the 1 through 120?
There's no difference in terms of the interference. In terms of the historical record, it is true that at this point, the 1 to 120 band has been more or less cleared of the original users, mm-hmm. and the so-called MIPS pack users, the people who used to be all the way at the one end of the band, are in the process of beginning to move. About 100 of those people have actually moved into their new spectrum. And so there is the risk of interference for those people who have been moving in, and that risk will increase as more people move in.
Is the petitioner correct that the commission is granting extensions to NIPSPAC users that it's not granting to Sprint, which are, in their terms, inconsistent?
Well, petitioner is correct that the commission, subsequent to the order on review here, I might add, which is a highly material fact,
yep.
has granted some minor extensions in some planning deadlines. You know, we're talking a couple months here and there that the public safety entities requested, and it has granted that. I think it's highly relevant to your question, though, Judge Sentell, that the commission has established a waiver process under which if any public safety entity is granted a waiver beyond the June deadline, in other words, beyond the 36 months, then Nextel may ask for its own waiver, and you know, so it will have the significant possibility of
done, or the commission has done so far would rule out the possibility of a waiver for Sprint?
Oh, absolutely not. The commission has affirmatively set forth the possibility of a waiver for Sprint. Now again, we're talking about the 1 to 120 spectrum, not the interleaved spectrum. The interleaved spectrum is the real driver here for the interference concerns and for the additional public safety spectrum concerns.
But you don't, the commission does not have to treat the 1 to 120 and the interleaved sectors, our bands, the same.
I don't think it does, and it did not treat them the same. There's no waiver provision, for example, for the interleaved spectrum, but there is a waiver provision for the 1 to 120 spectrum.
What is the point of adhering to the June 26 deadline when if it's a given that Sprint can vacate on 60 days' notice?
Well, again, if you're talking about the interleaved spectrum, the point is that the sooner this spectrum is available for licensing, the faster that will go.
Well,
and
is
also
that to say that if they're given 60 days' notice, the user might be cooling its heels, ready to move? And
it could be. It might be a little bit like, you know, if you want to move into an apartment, the people have to move out first. Keep in mind.
But you know, ordinarily, one tries to anticipate these things, and if you have to give 60 days' notice, you give it.
Right. Keep in mind also there's the interference aspect of the question. Also, getting Sprint out of the spectrum, that we're talking interleaved here particularly, will reduce the amount of interference that the current public safety occupants of that spectrum are experiencing. And so, in other words, there are two policies. There's the freeing up the spectrum and there's the interference. I have been told by the staff who tracks these things that the interference reports for the last year or so are roughly the same as they've been for the last 3 or 4 years. And so the commission, as far as its data show, has not experienced a significant reduction in interference reports. I think that You have to take into, you have to realize that in terms of Sprint's argument that the public safety people have said, let them move out on 60 days notice, Sprint has objected to that. Sprint's position is we're not leaving until the whole thing is done. They object to the public safety approach. The commission hasn't, you know, ruled on that, of course, and that's not a proposal that was before the commission at the time. It's not something that, at the time of the order that's on review, it's not something that Sprint argued. It's not something that the public safety people argued at that time. And so it's, again, you know, it's not fair to put the commission on the hook for something that wasn't before it at the time. I think that putting the commission on the hook for things that weren't before it is also highly relevant to some of Sprint's claims about the effect on its network.
Unless you're answering a question,
I do have
yes, Judge Brown.
Sprint makes the point that some of their customers are actually public safety units. Also complains that the commission didn't respond to that expressed concern.
Well, I think that the court was discussing this with Mr. Wright, and it was focusing on paragraph 26 of the order that's on review. This is a JA-9. I'll give you a minute to find that.
Paragraph
26, Judge Ginsburg. And remember, the commission is responding to the argument that was made in the ex parte letter. It's not responding to much more extensive and significant declarations that were submitted to the court for the purposes of Sprint's stay motion. Okay, they're very different. The ex parte letter says, you know, we've got some public safety users, you know, don't mess with them. The declarations. Okay, but so the commission in paragraph 26 did, as Judge Santel was discussing with Mr. Wright, explicitly take that up. And it says, we disagree with Sprint's contention that requiring it to vacate spectrum by the deadline would seriously harm public safety. To the contrary. And then they go on and they list a bunch of public interest factors. And I think that
I understand that they do that, but what I'm trying to get at is the specific reference to Sprint's IDIN system, which is, in fact, used by first responders. And the fact that I understand them to be saying if they have to vacate all of this band, everything, that then those customers who are, in fact, part of our public safety system will also not have that available to them.
Okay, I think it's very important to recognize, Judge Brown, that when we're talking about Sprint vacating, we're not talking about Sprint vacating all of its 800 megahertz spectrum. It has significant amounts of 800 megahertz spectrum in parts of the band that are not either the interleaved or the general category. And Sprint's, their argument is not that we will go out of business, all of our services will be shut down. Their argument, as they make it to the court now, is that if we have to leave this particular spectrum, there will be a higher incidence of dropped calls. It's not that they will be unavailable. It's not that it won't work. It's that it will be a little less, you know, every once in a while you might have a call that's dropped more frequently than it would be in the network that has all the spectrum. I think it's also important to realize that as the FOP brief, the Fraternal Order of Police amicus brief, points out, that the IDEN service that's used by public safety is a secondary system. All of these public safety agencies have an 800 megahertz system that they use as their primary radio contact, as their principal means of communicating. You can raise the disaster scenario, perhaps, but that's you know, the few and far between. The fact is that the Sprint network is a backup system. It's something that's there when you're not using the existing public safety system, which every police and fire department has, and which is very reliable. And so, I think in paragraph 26. To go back to your original question, Judge Brown, what the commission is doing is it's making a policy weighing. It's doing what the commission does. It's doing what Congress charged us with doing. It said, here's an argument on the one hand, possible harm to the Sprint system. Here's an argument on the other hand, significant public policy concerns involving interference to public safety systems, involving spectrum that's available to public safety systems. And it is saying that weighing these two things, we find that the harm to Sprint system is less important than interference and less important than denying needed spectrum resources. And it's saying, and so therefore, we will require Sprint to adhere to the 36-month deadline that it promised to adhere to. We will require them to live up to the terms of the deal.
Okay, I hate to do this, but I'm going to anyway. I heard a question from Judge Ginsburg earlier that I'm not sure I heard an answer to from you, and that is, inherently on the ex parte letters, can the ex parte letter concerning an ex parte meeting provide the function of notice to the commission as a matter of law? You're asserting that the commission was not on notice of these arguments. Now, without regard to whether the text of the letter is sufficient, as a matter of law, can the ex parte letter fill that need for jurisdictional purposes?
If the, I believe the court's precedents are that an ex parte letter that sufficiently documents an argument puts the commission on fair notice.
The commission is not disputing the legal theory of petitioners in that regard, but only the sufficiency of this particular.
I think that's correct. Yeah. Right. If so, this letter had been adequate.
So the situation is that one commissioner, let us say, here's an oral presentation. There's then the ex parte letter is filed, which puts other commissioners and third parties on notice of the argument, and that's notice to the commission?
Well, you know, I think that under the court's precedence, I could make an argument, but, you know, the court has also has its own interpretation.
Yeah,
and so,
the president against you on that?
Well, okay.
The cases
that hold that there's a case that holds that if a commissioner dissents on a particular issue, that the majority did not.
No, that's distinguishable.
Right, and so.
Well, now on this question of whether the ex parte letter is sufficient to provide notice.
Okay.
Is there a case on that question?
I don't know whether there's a case specifically on the question of whether an ex parte. I can tell you that there are four or five cases that have been decided that have involved ex parte notices, and I don't think anybody's challenged the idea that the ex parte notice was, insufficient as a threshold legal matter.
Well, you might as well get ready for it.
It could matter if this case might be the one that raises it, but if this one doesn't.
It's coming.
It's coming.
Well, we'll be happy to deal with that at the time.
Thank you,
Your Honors, and we recommend that
not
the
only is your
court
time up, but we've extended it firms significantly by our question.
I appreciate
that's
it.
What we're here for, I think. Mm-hmm. That's part of what we're here for. Yeah. All right. Now, you had used your time up also. We'll give you about 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be very quick. Very quickly, in our opening brief, we devote 8 pages to a contract argument. We devote 9 pages to an arbitrary and capricious agency action argument. I think there's merit to the contract action, but we'd be happy to win on the second argument, which is squarely before.
Earlier, I thought you told us you're not bringing a contract action.
Well, I wasn't going to dispute this. The contract argument starts, the SEC abused its discretion because, and it uses the word contract, but so we think that's an APA argument too, but there's absolutely no dispute that the second one's a pure APA argument and is based on the same unreasonable change of course. Second, let me just note that the SEC tries to ignore everything in the ex parte letter that's described as a policy flaw. Your Honor, it is unreasonable under the APA, it is arbitrary and capricious to change policy course without providing an adequate justification. When someone tells the FCC there's something wrong with their policy, they are always
that
making.
That brings us back to the recurrent question. What is the best statement in this joint appendix that puts the FCC on notice of the argument you're making to this court? They're saying we don't have jurisdiction because you hadn't raised it at the commission level, What's the best place to look for where you rated at the commission level?
But Your Honor, just in the ex parte letter, again.
We're talking about at 816.
Yes, we use the words.
The best language there to put them on notice is precisely this. I've got 816 and 817. I thought that would be your answer, so that's what I'm open to. Right.
The best language is the sentence that says that Nextel's, quote, acceptance of the 800 megahertz obligations was premised on receiving synchronized replacement spectrum, which follows use of the word swap five times, follows the use of some form of synchronize five times, and it includes accepts, and there's an accepted. No one could read that letter without knowing our position is that the FCC is trying to unreasonably get rid of the synchronized replacement spectrum swap aspect of its orders, and that's what we're objecting to. That's what we objected to before.
You could have said it a lot more clearly, counsel. I understand your argument that people reading that should have gotten the message that you're now very clearly giving us, but you sure could have given it to the commission as clearly as you gave it to us. I mean, there's a lot of phrasings of your position in your brief to us.
Well,
you know what your argument
Your Honor, you
say that raises the issues you have before us. That's a pretty generous reading of your prose, isn't it, Johnson?
I don't think so, Your Honor, but let me cite the 1996 Southwestern Bell decision where this court has some very nice language saying that, of course, the court benefits from the fact that the arguments before the court are typically much more polished and much lengthier than the arguments in the administrative record. My recollection of that case is there was a paragraph lost in a sea of material that turned into a lengthy argument in a brief, and that was good enough. Again, here, Your Honor, I'd ask
there
you.
There is, however, a response here in paragraph 26 that you're saying is an inadequate response. And I didn't make up that phrase about this so-first response to a Salazar argument. That's from a prior case, too, where we said you don't have to have one.
Your Honor, Your Honor, the only evidence in the record that I know of at that time is the Virginia Beach and Fairfax County and others coming in to seek extensions, and telling the commission they're not suffering from unacceptable interference. A one sentence undocumented response. Don't think it's enough. If I
could you have petitioned for a reconsideration of this third memorandum in order?
Your Honor, we could have. We sought expedition by this court instead, which this court granted. Nextel's in danger of losing lots of channels on June 26th. And if I can just say, we're not getting kicked off, Judge Brown, but as shown in great detail, particularly in paragraphs 12 and 13 of the confidential declaration in the separate appendix, the sort of loss of channels that is contemplated here is not just a bad thing for the network. We described it as crippling the network. It hurts us very badly. And I'm sorry, Your Honor, I got myself sidetracked and lost myself.
I got you way off time, so if you would like another 30 seconds to close in, take 30 seconds.
One more point then. Paragraph 23 of the FCC's order talks about the 60-day requirement. Nextel does not object to the 60-day requirement. We think we could have, but Nextel will vacate its channels with 60 days notice. To the extent there is a problem, the FCC has identified and solved it, Your Honor, and Nextel's being reasonable here, the FCC isn't. We'd ask the court to issue its order as soon as possible or announce its judgment, because Nextel needs to make steps to find out what its network's going to be on June 27th. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Give the case is submitted. Give us recess.
Stand, please.